I'm Tom Hall. It's opening day, and it's midday. Today, a preview of a powerful new film about the last 3 years of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The renowned historian Taylor Branch is an executive producer of the HBO documentary King in the Wilderness, a compendium of reflections by King's closest friends about a period that was one of the most tumultuous in American history and one of the most personally challenging and difficult for the iconic civil rights leader as he struggled to confront racism, poverty, and militarism. King in the Wilderness will be screened tonight at the Parkway Theater. Taylor Branch joins me in Studio A to talk about it. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Aubergine at the Everyman Theater. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday on this opening day. First pitch, 3:05, just about 3 hours from now. Dylan Bundy takes the mound for the Orioles, Jake Odorizzi for the Minnesota Twins, so go O's. So it's an important day today, and next Wednesday also a very important day. It marks the 50th anniversary since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down as he stood on a balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. A new documentary film chronicles the last 3 years of Dr. King's life and the myriad challenges he faced in that tumultuous time. It's called King in the Wilderness. My guest today is one of the executive producers of the film, Taylor Branch. He's an internationally acclaimed historian and author whose three-part trilogy on the civil rights movement is called America in the King Years. In 1988, he won the Pulitzer Prize for History for the first volume in that trilogy, Parting the Waters. The movie draws on interviews conducted by Taylor Branch and Trey Ellis with Dr. King's friends and colleagues in the civil rights movement. Some of the figures are well known: Harry Belafonte, Andy Young, Jesse Jackson. Others are less well known, but they were very close to Dr. King and his family, and they played important roles in King's historic work. In the film, they recall with great poignancy the tremendous pressures that King faced as he expanded the civil rights movement from the South to the North, and as he coupled the fight for racial equality with opposition to the Vietnam War and efforts to eliminate poverty. I've had the great pleasure of seeing King in the Wilderness. It is a stunning movie. It's a wonderful compendium of deeply personal insights about a man that most of us know only in his status and as an historic icon. This film is revelatory in every frame. It's being screened tonight at the Parkway Theater at 7 o'clock, and after the screening, Taylor Branch and DeRay McKesson will lead a discussion. I encourage you to join us tonight at the Parkway, and I'm delighted that Taylor Branch joins us in Studio A. It's good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Tom. Thanks.
Let me also mention we are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page, and a little bit later we'll take your calls, questions, and emails. So, Taylor, let's talk a little bit about the trajectory of Dr. King's work. It started in the mid-50s with the bus boycott in Montgomery, and this movie concentrates on the last 2 or 3 years of his life. Contrast those last few years with that first period, the first 12 or so years of his career in the civil rights movement.
Well, the first part of King's career concentrated on issues of Southern segregation, which have been tucked away with his I Have a Dream image in the familiar Martin Luther King. The latter years of his career focus on all the issues that are still with us today. We're still stuck in wars like Vietnam and poor countries around the world, and we have race issues in the North, and we have poverty issues and economic dislocation issues. So it's a very contemporary King. Personally, to me, the big difference is that in the early years, the I Have a Dream years, King had the same principles and audacity to say that he wanted not only to fix segregation, but to address mankind's evils of war, bigotry, and poverty, which he called violence of the flesh and violence of the spirit, which is just breathtaking when you think that it was a minority that that was segregated and largely invisible, but they wanted to fix mankind. But he was reluctant. He didn't go in the freedom rides. He was reluctant to join the sit-ins. this part shows a more driven king. He is driven to go north. Most of the staff didn't want to go. They wanted to stay in the south. He said, we have to show that race is not and never has been just a southern issue. And he was driven to come out on Vietnam when everybody advised against it. And he was driven to address poverty, finally, among sanitation workers in the end, when the staff didn't want to do that either. So he's really possessed to make witness here.
You've written, you've lectured, and this movie makes clear that his aspirations really were, as you've phrased it, more than just getting people to the front of the bus. I mean, his aspirations were to literally redeem the soul of America.
And he said that right from the beginning. And his Nobel lecture said that the freedom movement was spreading the widest liberation in human history, and because it had unleashed nonviolence as a weapon against mankind's triple scourges of bigotry, war, and poverty, and he recommended it. And to me, it introduces the great disconnect, because all of our problems are so contemporary. You see, this film could be taking place today, and yet had we listened to him then, our politics wouldn't be so cynical, because it's true that an awful lot of liberation has been loosed in the Soviet Union and apartheid South Africa and here for women and the disabled and gays and lesbians and everything. But because we don't have King's optimism, we live in a cynical politics.
He was optimistic. However, this movie also shows a Dr. King that was rife with self-doubt. And questioning himself. Here's a little clip from one of the people you interviewed for the movie, Harry Belafonte, talking a little bit about Dr. King's sort of, you know, state of mind.
Martin's moments when the curtain was drawn and he was not on public display was a man who revealed his deepest concerns about his right to do what he was doing. The fact that he was touched by that calling in history disturbed him because he didn't quite understand it. He referred everything to divine intervention, to divine power. It's what God has called on me to do. And in the depth of that belief, that religious commitment, those voices that he heard really existed for him.
It's fascinating to hear Mr. Belafonte talk about Dr. King being disturbed by the calling to do the work he was doing.
Yes, he was a conscience-driven person, and it's fascinating to hear Harry Belafonte say that, because when he first met Dr. King, Belafonte, like a lot of entertainers, was profoundly skeptical of Baptist preachers and of religion in general. So Belafonte really caught a severe case of Dr. King in the sense that he's a militant person who doesn't suffer fools lightly, and yet he is devoted to nonviolence, and he sees how powerful that tool was. So, yes, Harry's among the witnesses here. The film, by the way, does not have a narrator, and it doesn't have any talking head historians like me. Because one of our premises is that King has been, I have a dream, and people think they have it and they're tired of it, and he's been packaged wrongly, but we don't want to substitute another package. We want to show all of these witnesses revealing King, addressing issues that are still pertinent today in such a great framework, and let people decide what they think. We wanted to show a real Martin Luther King in a way that is surprising to most people.
Yeah, and it is surprising, and it's wonderful, and the range of people that you choose to talk to, there are people that you've heard of, Andy Young, Jesse Jackson, Harry Belafonte, but there are a bunch of people whose names are not as familiar to people unless they've, you know, done close reading of your work and others. But these are people who are on the ground next to Dr. King all the time.
Yeah, like Bernard Lafayette. Nobody knows him very much. He was close to John Lewis and Diane Nash, who's also in the film, in Nashville, and John Lewis is in the film. But Bernard Lafayette stayed with those people all along, and he's the last person that Dr. King talked to before Bernard was coming back to Washington, flew flew back to Washington from Memphis to take Dr. King's place. He was staying to do this march in Memphis that he didn't get to do because he was shot. And on the way out, Dr. King said, "Bernard, our next move is that we're going to internationalize nonviolence and try to apply it to issues like apartheid in South Africa and the Soviet Union." So in spite of all the anguish, the ambition and the inspiration is still there. I think you can hear that in King's voice. It's this strange furnace of he wasn't Pollyanna, but of reality and hope.
And the movie is entitled King in the Wilderness. It's so poignant to see that tape again of Dr. King being introduced on the night before he's assassinated in Memphis, giving a speech to the people who were there for the march for the sanitation workers. And the man who introduces him says, "The Moses of 1968.
Yeah, that's Ralph Abernathy introducing him. And and you have Bernard Lafayette and talking about how he was in his pajamas. It was raining and he didn't want to go. And that Jesse Jackson called from this hall and said, "These people here want to hear you. They came out in the middle of this torrential rain, and won't you come?" And he said, "You mean you want me to get up and take my pajamas off and get dressed and come out in the rain just to say hello?" And they said yes.
Because his speech that night wasn't even supposed to be the main event.
No, he was just supposed to say, "I'm glad you're here." But he was, as others in the documentary say, he was a natural-born preacher. He could tumble out of a nap and start a sermon. And that's what he did that night.
But Andy Young mentions in the movie that Dr. King was, to a certain extent, running out of gas. He says that he was aware of the fact that the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, had not hardly raised the issue of poverty. He thought that, you know, that was a real failing of the movement. And there were he seemed just conflicted after. I mean, 64, there's the Civil Rights Act. 65, there's the Voting Rights Act. And then after that, a number of things caused a great conflict, inner turmoil in his own mind.
Well, I think a lot of it was that he wanted to apply his witness. Some people say that he changed his mind or he changed his views. I don't think so, because you hear the same things early in the 50s about what his worldview was. It's just that he wanted to make witness in all the areas where he thought it applied. And one of the first ones was to go north, say, "We have to go north because millions of Americans think the race problem is only in the South." And what happened was that as he moved into anti-war and into anti-poverty, I think the anguish was that the world that was willing to follow him into Selma and to I Have a Dream and stopped and faded away and refused to go. Essentially, what America said was, okay, maybe we were a little excessive in our race relations with Southern segregation, but that's about as far as we're willing to go. And we don't like you talking about racial conditions where people are crammed into ghettos in the North. And we don't like you talking about our foreign policy. He thought and believed that he was espousing and making witness on a consistent philosophy, but that he was all of a sudden being rejected.
He and the people in the movement thought about various cities that they could take up camp to have the anti-poverty campaign. They settled on Chicago. He goes up there. Andy Young goes up there with him. A bunch of people go up to Chicago. And he talked then about the difference and the difficulty of fighting poverty as opposed to fighting segregation and racism. He says that the cost, there was very little cost when it came to the sort of moral judgment about racism and segregation. But there's an actual cost when it comes to the fight against poverty, because certain people were going to need to be subsidized and lifted up to get a head start. Was that a constant conflict with him as well?
Sure. And he also said, just even on race in the North, it's not as obvious as a colored sign. But all you have to do is look at the neighborhood patterns that persist in cities, including ours, and ask yourself, is it an accident that these patterns are like that? And the answer is no. So, yes, he said things are not as obvious. Things are, I think Harry said, King said, that race and poverty are subverted in the North. You don't see them. You can, unless you choose to look.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Taylor Branch. He is a MacArthur Fellow and the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His 3-volume trilogy called America in the King Years is considered the seminal work on the history of the civil rights movement. We're talking about a new film on which Taylor Branch is an executive producer. It's called King in the Wilderness. It's going to be screened tonight at 7 o'clock at the Parkway Theater. That's the home of the Maryland Film Festival. This is a one-time screening in Baltimore before it premieres on HBO Monday night. Tickets are $25, and we'll have a link to get them online, wypr.org/midday. You can also get them at the door, and there will be a limited number of $5 community discount tickets sold tonight on a first-come, first-serve basis. Doors open at 6 o'clock. The screening will be followed by a discussion with Taylor Branch and the activist DeRay McKesson. We'll have more with Taylor Branch when we come back from a quick break. We'll take your questions and comments. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. You can call us at 410-662-8780. Email us at midday@wipr.org and find us on Twitter at @midday_WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday on this opening day. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with Krish Vignaraja. She's a former policy director for Michelle Obama and a senior advisor in the State Department during the Obama administration. She's on the ballot in the Democratic primary for governor, and she'll be my guest here in Studio A tomorrow on midday. And by the way, looking ahead to next week on Wednesday, April 4th, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., my guests will be the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown of the Black Church Food Security Network and Aretha's Freedom School here in Baltimore, the Reverend Dr. Anthony Hunt, a local pastor and a King Scholar, and Marsha Braden of the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights. So that's coming up on the actual anniversary of Dr. King's passing next Wednesday. If you've just joined us, we're talking about Dr. King as well today with the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch. He's the author of America in the King Years, a three-part trilogy on the history of the civil rights movement, and he's an executive producer of a powerful new HBO documentary film called King in the Wilderness. The film will be screened tonight at the Parkway Theater in Baltimore, and it will be followed by a discussion with Taylor Branch and the activist DeRay McKesson. The screening starts at 7 o'clock, and the film will begin airing on HBO on Monday night. Our phone number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. And as I mentioned, we are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page for those three of you who are still subscribed to Facebook. Let's talk about the Vietnam War, Taylor. When Dr. King came out against it, his staff was opposed to it. Just about everybody was opposed to it. He gave a speech at the Riverside Church a year to the day before he was assassinated. But that was something that he just stuck to his guns despite complete opposition to almost everybody from almost everybody he knew.
That's right. The film shows how much opposition there was, and then how much painstaking effort they went to have his speech in a respectable setting to give the maximum chance for people to at least hear the substance of his argument, which was, I don't dispute anybody's desire for freedom in Vietnam or anywhere, but you have to think about what we're doing and the history of our involvement with colonialism in Vietnam and so forth. And he gave this tour de force, never mentioned Lyndon Johnson. He said, this is our war. He didn't try to blame it just on Johnson. And he went to the Riverside Church, and then what happened was that the next day everybody dismissed it. Nobody paid any attention to any of that substance. They just said, you should stick to civil rights. How dare you criticize a war? And you see how powerful warlike race is, a very powerful thing in which it kind of turns your morality upside down, and not to kill in Vietnam became kind of treasonous. So black civil rights leaders, as well as the New York Times and the Washington Post, just turned against Dr. King the very next morning.
Here's a little clip from the speech that Dr. King gave April 4th, 1967, the year before his death.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
And the consequences of that decision not to be silent are really enormous. I mean, the movement, people stopped donating money. His friends stopped calling him. Roy Wilkins made an editorial. He's the head of the National Urban League that said that Dr. King spoke for himself, not the movement. I mean, people just ran kicking and screaming from him.
Yes, and that was in 1967. The war was 2 years old, and it went on until 1975. So
yeah,
it went on another 8 years, and probably nearly 2 million more people died because we didn't listen to Dr. King.
And it's in the context of that that his relationship with Lyndon Johnson changes, because he and Johnson, of course, had worked very closely on the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and now he's dissing Johnson. I mean, you mentioned that he doesn't say Johnson's name in that speech at Riverside Church, but he and Johnson are now on opposite sides.
Yeah, you can hear the tension. There's some tapes that are included in the film of King talking to Johnson, and it's really poignant. History was cruel that there was no break between the heights of the Civil Rights Movement and the beginning of the Vietnam War. They started in the same year, 1965. And King said, Johnson said, the best thing that ever happened was when you went to Selma and allowed us to make that speech. But I hear some people are telling me that you're against me on Vietnam, and I don't want war any more than you do. And you hear Johnson kind of anguishing over the Vietnam War, but he gets dragged into it, and he ignores King's advice to basically practice nonviolence in Vietnam.
Despite all of that, he does go ahead with the Poor People's Campaign, moves to Chicago, 1967, and this is a year in which—
Now, Tom, wait a minute.
Do I have that right?
Chicago is 66.
66, so he was there already.
And the Poor People's Campaign begins after the Vietnam thing.
Well, the war on—
The national—
What is the Chicago movement called?
It's called the Movement to End Slums.
To End Slums.
It's basically to address racism in the North. But there was a focus on the ghettos and the policies that concentrated people in slums and that sort of thing, which were all those marches where they were violently attacked in Chicago for even going into non-integrated neighborhoods.
Right, and they're living, Dr. King is living in this slum project.
With no heat.
With no heat in Chicago.
Very dramatic footage there. I mean, I hope people don't see familiar things. I mean, that's our goal. That's one of the reasons we don't have talking heads like me in there telling everybody what to think. This should be for people who think they already know what the Civil Rights Movement is. I hope that there's new material in almost every frame to say this is different than what I thought it was.
And I'm getting the terms mixed up, but the Poor People's Campaign was the idea of Marion Edelman, I guess, too. And this was something that Dr. King was working on when he went to Memphis.
Marion Edelman took him the idea, which actually she got from Robert Kennedy. By the way, just a personal note, she was Marion Wright, and Robert Kennedy, when he went to investigate poverty in Mississippi, brought his chief aide, Peter Edelman, and Marion wound up marrying him. Marion Edelman. But Robert Kennedy was so affected by the poverty he saw in Mississippi that he suggested that he said, Congress will never do anything about poverty in the abstract. You have to force them to do it. And the analogy, by the way, was the bonus marchers came to Washington in the 1930s starving and were run out of town by the Army. But 12 years later, they passed the GI Bill, which, and King was hoping that by analogy that even if the Poor People's campaign got run out of Washington, that it would make a witness, and that years later the government would do something analogous to what they did in the GI Bill in 1944.
Taylor Branch is an executive producer on King in the Wilderness, a movie that's going to be screened tonight at the Parkway Theater. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page, and you can find us on Twitter at @MiddayWIPR. So he's in the middle of the movement to end slums, and of course we all remember the riots that broke out after Dr. King's death in 1968. But the movie reminds us that in 1967 there were 80 different riots going on around the country. In 1965 was the riot in Watts, in which Dr. King went to L.A. to try to intervene and have cooler heads prevail. The time of the country was incredibly difficult and tense.
Yeah, it was. Those riots are basically wake up America. The problem of race is not just segregated libraries and segregated lunch counters in the South. That it's greater than that. You've had millions of black people migrate out of the South into the North, and we hardly noticed. And the riots were a way of forcing attention on that.
I wonder. I mentioned that Dr. King made note of the fact that anti-poverty, in a way, was harder than civil rights because there was a cost involved into the taxpayer. But the current movement for equality and social justice, the current movement about police misconduct. We just had this horrible incident yet again in California, in Sacramento, when Stephon Clark is an unarmed black man killed by police. The cost of white supremacy is that white folks have to learn to give up some power, to cede power. So there is a cost over and above a financial cost for addressing poverty. I wonder if you see any analogies or any lines between what King was talking about when it came to ending poverty and linking that to ending racism and militarism and the current calls for movements like Black Lives Matter.
Well, I do. I think basically the issues that King addressed in this film are as contemporary as today's newspaper. The question is whether the young people, we can't fight the war the same way he did, but the question is whether the principles and the thoughts that you can feel in this film would be applicable to the young people and old people today trying to take up as citizens and restore hope. We are in a cynical climate, and if you look at Dr. King, he had a lot more reason to be cynical than we did living in a segregated America, and he wasn't. And so at the very least, that is a model for us. But I think there are a lot more when people see this struggle.
You have been talking about the deleterious effects of cynicism in politics and cynicism in government for a long time. I mean, decades. Why do you think we are in such a cynical age? And why do you think that the cynicism has actually been exacerbated in the last 10 years from when it started? You know, you could perhaps date it from the Reagan administration, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, we don't seem to be making much progress in that regard. And, you know, Exhibit A, the president of the United States was elected, as being one of the most cynical candidates in American history.
Yes. But he made his name by making overt the racial appeal and saying that Obama was not a legitimate American, so he's making overt a lot of the things that are subterranean. Dr. Du Bois said that after the Civil War, that the Confederates turned the animosity that they had focused on the Yankees toward black people in the South. And there have been people who said that, by analogy, after the 1960s, people turned the hostility that was in segregation toward the federal government that was making them abide by immigration. And I think that's a lot of the root of the cynicism, that we're cynical about the possibilities of we the people and what we can accomplish together. And that's a very dangerous attitude, you know.
The very last thing that Dr. King published was published posthumously in Look magazine. And as you say, he remained optimistic because he thought that there was a way out.
Yes, he did. He said that America's infected with racism. That's the problem, he said. But the hope is that America's also infected with democratic ideals. So it wasn't just spirituality or religion, as Harry mentioned, but, you know, Dr. King's gift was to put one foot in the Constitution and one foot in the Scriptures and say equal citizenship is our hope. And however hard it is, that's what you're going to see. And as you know, Tom, we've known each other a long time. I've been trying to make films about this with actors.
Yes, you have.
Miniseries and Jonathan Demme. And
yeah, based on your books.
This
right.
is the first one I've ever gotten on the screen, and I'm very excited about it because I think documentaries have limitations, but they also have a reality to them that I hope people will see here.
You are an historian who deals with primary sources, and this movie is nothing but primary sources. As you say, there's no talking heads. There's people who were there in the moment, witness to history, saying what their recollections are of that period of time, having known Dr. King as intimately and as long as they had. Do you think that these participants, these people who chose to be in this movie at your request, have an axe to grind, have an agenda? Is anybody trying to reshape in any, you know, sort of purposeful way one's understanding of King? I mean, or do they come into this movie saying, you don't really get it with King, let me set you straight?
Well, they do say, I was there, I saw it. But I think any fair person would say that these witnesses really feel right. There's a Jesse Jackson here I've never seen before. Jesse Jackson has always had his own axe to grind. But when he talks about the murder or even says, I feel his pain that he was isolated because his staff was against him, it's confessional because he was one of the ones saying, maybe Doc's over the hill now and I should take over back then. And so I think that these are people late in life. And maybe this is their deathbed confession, but I think it comes across with that authenticity, not just for them, but even people like Joan Baez. You know, they're speaking like it's their last chance to say what they really feel.
There's a remarkable scene during the march that Dr. King joined after James Meredith was shot in Mississippi, and he's marching with Stokely Carmichael, and there's a reporter who's interviewing both of them. And Stokely Carmichael, of course, is the inspiration behind the Black Power movement, which was antithetical to nonviolence and Dr. King's movement. And they're the two of them walking down this road together, defending their positions. It's a remarkable piece of tape.
I'm glad I hope people will see how remarkable that is. They've got Frank McGee from NBC in a ridiculous getup marching between them through the streets, and he's passing the microphone back and forth, and Dr. King's talking about nonviolence and Stokely Carmichael's talking about Black Power. Those debates went on all night. The world was captivated by Black Power. Stokely's sexy and assumed that they were becoming bitter enemies because one was an attack on the other. In fact, those debates went on all night. Stokely said they became friends. You actually see from Cleveland Sellers, one of Stokely's people there, that they would go over and have dinner with Dr. King, that they were kind of on the same side. But for the rest of the world, Black Power and militancy and the war kind of eclipsed the potential of nonviolence, which is one of the tragedies that began to haunt Dr. King.
And you talk about in the movement, or the movie makes clear to a certain extent, the fact that the movement was very strategic. I mean, they would try things, and then if it didn't work, they'd do a little postmortem and say, okay, what about that was a good thing? What about that was a bad thing? So they were thinking strategically politically. They were thinking strategically what they wanted to do and accomplish on the street. It's really fascinating. And one of those things that comes up is that when Dr. King went to Memphis— the staff said, don't do that. We don't know anything about this march that's going to happen, the first one. You know, we don't know anything. We didn't plan it. We weren't involved. You know, we don't know who these people are. And it ended up badly.
Yes, it did. It wasn't strategic enough there. But I think the fact that it was strategic, that it took a long time, that they wouldn't take a failure to be the final answer, including that one. Dr. King was determined to go back and have a nonviolent march in Memphis afterwards and just died the night before. That might be one of the things that people today can take away from this, how strategic it is, that whatever you're doing in your, maybe the Occupy movement didn't last because it wasn't strategic enough. The civil rights movement lasted by arguing all night, you know, what did we do wrong and how can we fix it?
But did it also last because of the charisma, the genius, the presence of Dr. King? Once he was, I mean, you mentioned that there were people making moves to replace him before he died. He was only 39 years old when he died, but the movement did, to a certain extent, fall apart after his assassination.
Yes, Andy Young confesses that openly. He said we couldn't hold it together without him. He did have, you know, some of that was because of the war and things that were pulling it apart, but he was the voice that held things together. There were times when he himself said that the students were ahead of him by way of sacrifice in the Freedom Rides and that sort of thing. So he wasn't always indispensable, and the movement was bigger than him. But he was indispensable as a voice who tried to kind of set the framework. And, you know, that's what we need today. We have disparate movements going on in Me Too and guns and the marches by these inspirational kids. But coming together in a voice that can last long enough to get something done. You know, hope is easier than change is the big challenge now.
The relationship between Dr. King and his father, Daddy King, really just fascinating and nuanced and layered, as all of our relationships with all of our fathers are. But boy, this was an extraordinary relationship.
Yeah, it is. And I don't believe I've seen that in any film. Harry Belafonte is such a great witness on it, because he had to deal with Daddy King a lot himself. You know, Harry took out a life insurance policy on Dr. King because he lived in such poverty. He was only worth, his net worth was $20,000 when he died, and that was because some things hadn't been passed on into the treasury. And Daddy King hated that. Daddy King was an entrepreneur. But yes, this relationship, there are a lot of funny scenes actually in the film, and poignant ones about Daddy King, who breaks down over the casket. And it introduces the humor, too, because there are a lot of scenes of people trying to describe Dr. King's humor, which is very difficult. It's kind of a gallows humor mimicry. He would mimic your foibles and preach your funeral.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. Andy Young talking about that. He would make up funeral speeches, funeral eulogies, right in front of the person he was.
Right in front of him. And for Andy, it was always painful, because Dr. King would say, Andy, you're the kind of Negro that thinks that if you memorize every sonata by Mozart, that white people will respect you and forget that you're black. So he would say.
The relationship with Coretta. You mentioned that the film makes clear that Coretta was against the war, came out against the war in Vietnam before Dr. King himself. But the stress on that family, the stress on the children, the stress on the marriage, exacerbated by the fact that J. Edgar Hoover was wiretapping many of Dr. King's phone calls and making public, personal foibles that Dr. King had. Did your understanding of Coretta and the impact of her in his life change any in the making of this movie?
Not a lot. I did much more work over my years in writing about the relationship of the FBI, because I think that is such a betrayal of its standards. And the film shows just right out there, we will at the proper time, without embarrassment to the Bureau, which was their standard thing, expose King as an immoral opportunist who is exploiting the racial situation for personal gain. So speaking of cynicism, that's like a large capsule, a cyanide capsule of cynicism dropped down there and we show things like that. So Dr. King is responsible for his own failures in the marriage. We as citizens are responsible for the FBI's intrusion in all that and its perversion of what its duty was. And the film shows both sides of that. I think the part that did, I was impressed by the witnesses saying no matter what the flaws were within their marriage, there was a respect there and a love that they held in the family, even when he was out on the road doing other things. And I think the film aspires to show people both sides of Dr. King.
I think it shows a side of Dr. King that many people will be very excited and surprised by. It's a remarkable movie, so congratulations. Look forward to seeing it tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Taylor Branch, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, a leading expert on Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, and an executive producer of the new HBO documentary film King in the Wilderness. It will be screened tonight at the Parkway Theater at 7 o'clock. The screening will be followed by a discussion with Taylor Branch and the activist and podcast host, DeRay McKesson. This is a one-time screening in Baltimore before it premieres on HBO Monday night. Tickets are $25, and we'll have a link to get them online at wipr.org/midday. You can also get them at the door, and a limited number of $5 community discount tickets will also be sold tonight. First come, first serve. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Coming up after a break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with a review of Aubergine at the Everyman Theater. So stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.